BC Conservatives are suggesting to partner with a Easeway firm. It's a monorail. They're partnering with a monorail firm to evaluate the RFPs on that.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Recording this on March 23rd, 2017, and this is episode 25. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. We're a proud partner now of the Dark Horse Dot Report. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever you found this podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Before we get going this week, we have a couple quick follow-ups. First, minor correction, Nova Scotia, it turns out, actually is maybe a decent launch site.
Sort of. It's sort of okay if you're going to be doing polar orbits where basically launch from anywhere because you're going at 90 degrees to the rotation of the Earth, or high inclination orbits too, where actually getting further away from the equator's good. But if you aren't doing that, you're losing out on the benefit the speed of the equator gives when launching.
And I'm pretty sure the rest of our criticisms still stand in that it's a silly place. Second, we got some feedback about your comments, actually, about the universality of service from Patrick. He took issue with the statements, and I didn't say anything at the time because I wanted to focus mostly on the NDP leadership race and Pat Stogren's sort of interesting campaign launch, and we'll have to get a bit more into that. But basically, Patrick's also a veteran as well, and he talks about in his email to us how he has friends who became disabled during their time of service, and so this requirement meant they could no longer serve and they could no longer be involved in the military. And it sort of went along with my thoughts at the time, and I hadn't really given much consideration to the issue, in that as the military changes and as we get more into the sort of modern drone cyber warfare, there are roles that don't require you to be in Afghanistan ready to pick up a gun and charge the front lines. This isn't 1914 anymore, Scott.
Even so, there's still a necessity to be able to deploy to forward operating positions for a wide variety of stuff, including for domestic operations, too. And, well, there's definitely, I think, a role for people who aren't as physically capable to play within the overall security and defense infrastructure. I'm not convinced the military is necessarily the best spot for that, and it may be better to look at civilian employment within D&D or one of the other departments within the government that handles that, where the military is kind of a little special in that there's that being part of it comes with that kind of necessity to go into dangerous situations. That's kind of what separates the military from basically any other job out there. And nowhere else is there the, you know, unlimited liability where you can just be told flat out, you know, you're going there, it's going to kill you, but you have to go. And there's just enough of that difference. I'm not sure rolling back universality of service is a good way to approach it. And having non-deployable members who are indefinitely non-deployable does reduce the operational flexibility and capacity of the CF. So for that reason, I think we need to keep universality of service. But where Patrick made some good points, and I definitely agree with him, is that the military does also lose out when they release members who are skilled and experienced as well. It can be a rough transition. So I think there's areas there where the military could look at improving, bringing them as civilian employees in the training system, for example. I know some of the people who taught me how to use the C-7 were actual civilians who were on contract with the Department of National Defense and provided training at the leadership and recruit school for that. So there's roles where you can bring in non-military members who have that experience and work can help out without also complicating the fact that there's operational commitments that military members have to be able to fulfill.
Sure. It's a bigger, more complicated issue, and I think everyone's on board with the idea of, everyone's on board with saying they're in support of the idea of helping disabled veterans and people and making sure service people have options and opportunities, which is not always the case right now. But it's an evolving one. I don't think it's as simple. And of course, and we didn't really give it much debate because it wasn't the main focus. One thing we should have done, though, and the Boys in Short Pants brought this more to our attention through their latest episode, is we missed a big element of Pat Stogren's persona, which is his alter ego as P-At, symbol, the Rebel Guerrilla. Pat runs a sort of, I don't even know what to call it, sort of a consulting way of life, not a cult, that he tries to encourage his rebel army, his guerrilla army, whatever he calls it, through Facebook and his incredibly designed 1990s-era website, to be better people? I really don't get it, but it's awesome. So do check out therebelguerrilla.com if you want to learn more about Pat Stogren, and maybe try to order some merch while you're there.
It's definitely an interesting website, but there's just something about it that feels way out of place with the NDP.
And way out of place with just contemporary professional politics. But if you're looking, maybe he'll bring that authentic brand that everyone's always trying to go for if he does enter the race. And with that, let's jump into the first segment, Innovate the Middle Class. The Trudeau Liberals dropped their second big budget with not a lot of surprises and not a lot of excitement. There's bigger deficits and some cuts here and there. A lot of boutique tax credits are starting to go away, and some spending is being promised eventually.
Now, most people might naively assume that a budget is a big document full of numbers, but you know, this one's more of a exercise in publicity with a little numbers tacked in at the end. I think it takes 40 pages before you hit your first spreadsheet on there. And, you know, just largely full of spin with a little actual insight into what they're planning on doing.
The big focus this year is middle class, innovation, fuzzy buzzwords like you're saying, to just try to hope the economy gets better. Well, like I said, promising a bit more money to go to infrastructure, to go to childcare, but a lot of these are things that won't start until 2018, 2019.
Yeah, it's just hard to get a good sense of how this is going to materialize just from reading the budget. And like we were saying, there's a lot of kind of buzzwords and platitudes. One of my favorite lines is, innovation is, simply put, the understanding that better is always possible. But if you can manage to slog through pages and pages of that, you'll actually get some idea where the Liberal government sort of kind of wants to go, you know, in the future. There's what's actually interesting about this one is there's very little spending that's coming up this year. A lot of announcements about, you know, spending over 5 years, spending over 10 years, starting in 2018 or 2019 or whatever. And if I got to decide how the budget had to be released, what format, you know, you'd only be able to highlight the stuff that's actually being spent this year, and everything else has to be a footnote, because it really does not give a great picture to anyone just perusing what's in it on what the government will actually be spending this year from reading it. You'd have to dig into the tables that are tucked away at the end.
Well, one thing we do know they're going to be doing this year is applying the GST to ride-sharing services, so an Uber tax, as it were, I guess. Ideally making tax equality between taxis and Ubers.
That's a common sense thing. It makes really no sense for them to be GST exempt.
There's going to be...
This is just long overdue.
And there's going to be the tiniest of increases on wine and beer taxes, like a penny per bottle kind of thing, or 5 cents per 2-4, which is not something anyone will notice, but it's something everyone, I think, will remember.
Less than a penny a bottle.
But people will remember. They're also killing the Canada Savings Bonds, of which I had one when I think I was 5 and had it for a couple years. And then I got a $1,010 out of that $1,000 one my parents put in. And that's not surprising considering we have tax-free savings accounts and other vessels and GICs. Like, when I go to the bank, no one's like, oh, do you want to open a savings bond? Those don't get used anymore.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever had anyone ever try and sell me one before. And with very easy access these days, to the stock market through, you know, index funds and mutual funds and everything. It just really doesn't make, and bond funds and all of those, it just doesn't make a huge amount of sense to be offering these savings bonds. So this is a little overdue, I guess, to kind of remove this kind of antiquated, not particularly commonly used program anymore.
The other change that's getting a lot of ink spilled that I think is a bit overblown is they're cutting the transit tax credit that the Harper government introduced a few years ago. Basically, when you file your taxes, you can apply some questionable number of your transit passes through the year. And I say questionable because it's actually gone through a couple court cases where the CRA says, well, you can do your annual pass, but you can't do individual tickets. And then someone goes, well, that makes no sense because here in Vancouver, you might just use a reloadable card and maybe that counts. So they're getting rid of that, which just makes it a lot simpler. But this gave you 15% back on your taxes.
So it's a non-refundable tax credit. So like the people at the lower end of the income spectrum aren't actually paying basically any income taxes, don't really get anything out of it. The biggest help was kind of to the middle class
who still take transit.
It was one of those things that was very popular to announce, but just didn't have much of an impact, like 90% of the tax credits.
I would rather see the same amount of money just be spent on transit infrastructure or just trying to expand transit. Hell, if it even cost a lot, why not just spend that money on making transit free in one city? Pick a different one every year. I don't care. Like, literally anything would be better than just this tiny tax credit that only helps small number of people. I know I used it, but it's sort of like, it's like the charitable tax credit. It looks good on paper, but when you do your taxes, it doesn't actually save you that much. You still have to pay taxes with these things. You can't donate your way out of taxes, as I learned this year. Perhaps the biggest thing, though, that we did see them spend is a lot more this year actually publishing and printing the budget itself. So we know they spent that money.
Which is a little odd, because if you actually look at the budget document, it's very monochromatic. You wouldn't think it would actually cost a huge amount to print on a per-page basis compared to past years.
It's probably the quantity and the rushness of it, because they want to get a lot of copies into the hands of a lot of journalists during the lockup. So you have to have a lot of printers running very fast, and they have just like a sole source contract kind of thing.
Either that or red ink is quite expensive, which brings us to probably the main headline piece is the deficit is once again going upwards, this time to $28.5 billion, up from the projected $25.4 billion from the fall fiscal update. So the deficit keeps climbing. So that $10 billion that was all for infrastructure, it's basically gone the way of electoral reform, of empty campaign promise that was never going to be fulfilled. But it does kind of bring up the question of, what the hell are the Liberals doing that every time they come back to the deficit number, it's suddenly higher than last time? And they're not actually bringing out a huge amount of new spending on this budget.
They are talking in this budget, at least to their credit, about a slowly declining deficit over the next few years. It doesn't get them back to even or even surplus.
And I'd be a lot more confident in that if every projection they've done up to this point hadn't lowballed the deficit.
And the other thing to say to their credit is there aren't a lot of economists who are screaming bloody murder over this. You can find them, because you can find an economist to say almost anything. But in terms of Canada's fiscal health, like, it's still a modest, moderate budget deficit. We could be pissing away a lot more, like the United States. We could also be in a lot more of a precarious situation. People still trust Canada and trust that this country is not going to fall apart. So even if we owe lots and lots of money, our debtors are going to know we're going to be around to keep paying out on it.
The last several governments have all done a pretty good job at keeping the fiscal house in decent shape. And that's why we can just throw these new deficits onto our books without much concern. That also goes to what my concern is, that this government seems to be unconcerned with the sort of fiscal restraint the previous governments have shown. And it's that kind of disregard for the idea that, you know, when you're in a growing economy, budget should be more or less balanced or trending towards balance. And that this just, we're going to run deficits because we can run deficits, is not a particularly wise approach to public finance.
Well, for me, the bigger issue is the sort of accountability thing you were getting to a minute ago, where they said one number, and now they just sort of doubled it, and haven't really made the case that this is worth it. Like, the NDP has largely changed its tune from, we will run a balanced budget during the election, which people laughed at then, and now are really laughing at. But at least they're now talking about, all right, this is just a missed opportunity. There were chances to close tax loopholes for the rich that the Liberals used to talk about. And there's a chance that if you're going to spend this much, to start rolling it out. That's largely in line with what the alternative budget of, like, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives and other left-leaning think tanks put out is always, here's a bunch of places you could spend and invest in Canadians, in infrastructure, things that would actually start creating jobs, getting things going, if that's the way you want to do it. But it's not there, like we're saying.
Just overall, it's a pretty empty budget, and that's one of those areas you highlight with the tax credits and various tax giveaways that just not much happened on. Yeah, the transit thing got rolled back, but the buzz ahead of this, like a month ago, was that they were going to be looking at a broad overhaul of the tax credits and significantly rolling them back, particularly looking at some of the tax-free aspects of extended health plans that are employer-given benefits. The tax treatment of stock options was another one that had been floated, and it just didn't happen. And that's just not happening. This should probably be the tagline of this budget if it wasn't so buzzword-heavy on innovation.
All of that being said, though, on its own, this feels like there's nothing so egregious in it. Like, it's kind of no one's really happy with it. But if you already hated the Liberals, this gives you more ammunition. If you like them, you'll probably just ignore this and go, I wish that would have been a little bit better. But in terms of how this plays with their popularity, see, it sort of is like just to put it in neutral and just coast for a little bit longer.
Yeah, there's nothing that hurts them in this, but there isn't much that helps them in this either. And yeah, this is a budget for a government that's stuck in neutral.
Which is a really bad strategy at this time, given they're looking ahead to an election in a couple of years and they need to start plotting the course. Luckily for them, at least some of the spending will start in a couple of years and they can start pointing to the things that they promised. But otherwise, it just sort of puts into a narrative that the Conservatives are building on the, you know, tax and spend Liberals that are nickel and diming you. That's their big push this year. And that also sort of plays to the fundraising kind of scandals earlier. And when they kind of want to change the channel and make things a bit better, more positive for themselves, instead they just double down on, no, we're in power, just deal with us.
As we've alluded to, innovation featured heavily in the marketing and the buzz surrounding this budget. And there's a few items they're looking at. There's $950 million to support innovation superclusters and $400 million for a venture capitalist initiative, and $125 million to launch a pan-Canadian artificial intelligence strategy. So basically the government's going to be throwing a bunch of money at various companies in the hopes that they can pick some winners and stuff. But this just strikes me as, you know, more corporate giveaway, more, you know, throwing money at stuff, hoping something sticks to the wall. And, you know, if Justin Trudeau wants to play venture capitalist, he should probably leave politics, use that trust fund money, and start his own venture capital firm rather than adding over $1 billion between all of these onto the deficit that, you know, people are going to be paying for a generation from now.
Well, and these are in addition to all the various different programs and initiatives to support innovation of whatever kind you want to frame it. And I know the government is doing some consultations and some strategy on how to unify their innovation strategy, but it seems like that's still sitting on the shelf somewhere while they just, like you say, shotgun approach, hoping something works.
Andrew Coyne made a very good point that there's currently 147 different innovation programs by the federal government. And the one thing they haven't answered is, how does this extra money they're throwing at it make the country more innovative if 147 government programs haven't done it to date?
Well, you can only ask that question if this was a government that ran on having an evidence-based approach to policy. Wait, it was.
And that's one thing. They haven't backed up the kind of, the core idea behind this, that an Ottawa bureaucracy handing out checks is going to be a stimulus to innovation. And if they really want to spur innovation, maybe they should look at why the massive amounts of venture capital money out there aren't flowing into Canadian startups the same way. You know, if these were such great business opportunities that, you know, we can do run our own venture capital firm, the question you have to ask is, why isn't a venture capital firm doing this when they're significantly more risk tolerant than the government is?
Maybe we just need someone like Kevin O'Leary to run the government like Shark Tank.
No, if anything, this would probably be right out of a Kevin O'Leary budget too. That's exactly the sort of corporate handouts that pepper what little policy he does have.
But I don't imagine we'll find Trudeau and O'Leary publicly expressing admiration for each other's budgets anytime soon.
One of the more head-scratching announcements in the budget was that $8.4 billion in capital spending is being pushed off from the short term into the 2035 fiscal year. And that this was somehow supposed to help the delivery of a modern, more agile, and better equipped military. And that in particular, this was going to help with the acquisition and procurement of fixed-wing search and rescue aircraft and the modernization of the light armored vehicles. But these are projects that are currently underway. And if we're postponing the funding for this by 20 years, what the hell are they thinking on this? It just does not make any sense at all. And just yet another time, the Liberals are backing away from properly funding the military and delivering the equipment that, in theory, they said the military needs and have committed to, but they seem to be following the 90s decade of darkness as a model instead of something to avoid.
This looks like somewhere where they saw over $8 billion that they didn't have to put into their deficit number. And they know their voters and the people who are most supporting them aren't as concerned whether the army gets new toys, in the most brutal way of putting it. And they are putting some money towards veterans programs and some support, pennies relative to this. And that does nothing if the military doesn't have the tools they need while they're employed. And so it's, on one hand, the shifting of the burden to the future, which never works out well. And on the other is sort of backing away from what we know Trump and NATO is going to be pushing, is to reach that 2% per GDP spending on defense policy.
And you're right, it does not work out to postpone it. The fixed-wing search and rescue aircraft that they highlight, this has been a procurement that's already been pushed off time and time again. And they've literally been cannibalizing museum pieces to find the parts they need to keep the Buffaloes running. Like, they are well beyond the point where they needed a replacement. And now they're looking at 20 years to actually put out the money for this. Beyond the 20 years they already have postponed this. This is also search and rescue aircraft. It's like the thing that everybody, even the people who don't like the military, agree the military should be doing. That's what just makes this bizarre and basically moves it beyond just a lack of care and almost to a point of negligent disregard for the status of the military. But you are right. This is going to be a potential troubled area with the Trump administration. And rather than actually spending the money we should be spending anyway, they seem to be once again walking back and adding yet another potential source of conflict with the new administration in the States.
Well, perhaps instead the Trudeau Liberals will keep building tanks for the Saudis and other people instead of for our own troops.
Two areas that's going to affect us a little closer to home is the transit funding they've announced. The government announced they're going to be spending $3.4 billion over the next 3 years to upgrade and improve transit infrastructure in Canada. And it's going to be allocated based off ridership and population. So Vancouver is probably going to get a fair bit of that, just because we have a fairly high amount of transit usage in the city, and we're, third largest city in the country. So we'll be getting a fair bit of money for that, which is good. And they've highlighted the Broadway subway line that is long overdue and needed here. In addition, they've announced a national housing strategy where they're going to be spending $11.2 billion over the next 11 years. A lot of affordable housing initiatives and whatnot. Of course, the question that I'm left with is, why are we looking at a national strategy for what is the epitome of a local issue, housing?
There's lots of places where we need leadership to step in. Housing is probably the most clear one where there's been none. So having it at the federal level might not be the perfect or most intuitive answer, but in terms of our constitution, sometimes I think Canada gets a little too hung up on the division of powers. For example, in education, it's purely provincial and no one else dare touch it, which means the federal government doesn't know how many people are graduating in each province. And that means when universities are trying to figure out how many engineering spots, for example, they should open up or allow in, they're just sort of going by guess and some nonprofits that pool these numbers. Australia, for example, on the same constitutional framework, roughly, has a national education strategy. So there are reasons to have federal leadership. We have federal leadership on healthcare, even though health is a purely provincial issue. So housing, people move around, and there's an argument that someone needs to do something. And so it makes sense to have at least the federal government having an opinion on it. That doesn't mean they should be dictating down to the municipal level any more than just to say, look, here are the kind of priorities we think, but if you have better ideas, just run with it. So I'm not as worried about that. What I'm just worried about is these are fucking pennies. Like, for the transit funding, $3 billion over the next 3 years sounds initially good until you realize that's $1 billion a year, and the Broadway subway alone is probably going to cost more than that.
It's probably $2 billion for that and another $2 billion for the Surrey Light Rail system. So one metro area can't even finish their projects if they got all the money.
Well, and they are splitting their funding with the provincial and municipal governments, but that's still a lot of money to eat up really fast. And so that's just Vancouver. Then you also have Toronto, Calgary, Edmonton, Montreal. All the major cities in this country are desperate for transit infrastructure. If you want to transition to the green economy like the Liberals and the NDP are at least saying they do, and some Conservatives who you can count on one hand also support, there needs to be some effort to make this happen. Similarly with the housing, $11 billion over 11 years is, again, $1 billion. At least houses tend to be a little bit cheaper than subways, but how many houses are they really going to build?
And that's the problem. That's the problem with a lot of these affordable housing issues, is they're really hard to scale up. And that's where most of this effort's focused on the affordable housing side, at least on the national strategy portion of it. But if you don't solve the market imbalance that's causing this in the first place, you'll never get the amount of money allocated to this to actually provide affordable housing for those who can't get it on the market. And just to push back slightly on the national strategy thing, the federal government has a lot of responsibilities just with the stuff they are constitutionally empowered to do, that touching on an area where 95% plus of the policy challenges fall into the provincial and municipal jurisdictions might not be the best use of their scarce attention and resources. And that's kind of why we divide up the powers, is so that different groups can focus on different aspects. Although there's definitely an argument to be made for better data sharing between those different levels.
The housing strategy is something they've been talking about since at least June of last year, and it's something they're in collaboration with the provinces and municipalities at least. So it's not a new announcement, but it looks like something they've been working towards for a while having to throw money at.
Yeah, and well, not a new announcement describes a lot of the stuff in here. They've re-announced the same spending they announced last year.
So overall, budget gets a solid C minus, maybe. No one's angry beyond belief. No one's really happy, though. It'll keep them in power for another 2 years.
Yeah, most response is somewhere between whelmed and underwhelmed. Moving on to segment two, Phantom Tories. It's been a bit of a scandal in the Conservative leadership race, as last Thursday, Kevin O'Leary alleged widespread vote rigging and suggested that some of the new member signups weren't entirely legitimate.
And so when I first saw this, my immediate thought was, this is a Trump style, the election is rigged, I'm just trying to like throw it before it happens. But it,
and you weren't alone in that. Like, everybody was mocking him on Thursday for it. And even Brad Trost was mocking him, which is never a good position to be in.
But then on Friday, the Conservative Party of Canada came out and struck 1,351 names from its membership list after an investigation. So it turns out Kevin O'Leary was sort of right.
These memberships had been bought through just a handful of IP addresses with prepaid credit cards. The only way to get a membership is you have to purchase it with a credit card. And that's in theory to prevent multiple people from signing up, that they found a way around it using the prepaid cards.
Because what will happen in a lot of campaigns, and leadership campaigns especially, is an organizer will go into a community group or something like that and just, you know, make the presentation. Everyone will be on board and they'll just like ratchet through 30, 40 people at a time. You know, they'd either used to get them all on paper and now they can just say, all right, got all your names. We'll run those through on our credit card later. That's not how you're supposed to do it. Obviously, each individual person is supposed to express their clear, explicit consent and sign up. Where the story gets even more interesting is on Sunday, the Globe and Mail gets this sworn affidavit, which is signed by six Sikh Canadians who said that the president of the Conservative Brampton East Riding Association, Ron Chatha, who's part of Kevin O'Leary's team, actually, the Sikhs said Ron Chatha offered to pay for their membership. So where Kevin O'Leary was claiming there's vote rigging, it now looks like he had the closest ties to it, which is just kind of funny.
Yeah, the innuendo was that the 1,300 names were driven by the Bernier campaign, but that was never substantiated to the same degree that this was.
Well, and this affidavit was given to the Globe and Mail by the Bernier campaign, according to the Globe. So it is a way to clear your name by smearing your opponent. And so on Monday, you have Bernier more explicitly calling out O'Leary and Lisa Raitt starting to say all the cheaters in the race should be expelled. There's no evidence Kevin O'Leary himself knew what was going on. Leaders are often not involved in the sort of day-to-day signups of members and recruiting that. That goes to the local organizers. So it's not clear if O'Leary's dirty or not in this. But it kind of just muddies the whole water. And now, already by Tuesday, Bernier realized that there's so much mud going around that his camp is now not going to actually talk publicly about these complaints anymore, and they'll just direct them right to the party.
And not only that, they refused to share the affidavit with the CBC when they asked for it.
Well, Bernier wants to get rid of the CBC, so that's not that surprising. He's just playing favorites. What was surprising to me is Corey Tanecki is on Maxime Bernier's campaign. Tanecki, for anyone who doesn't remember, was the former vice president of Sun News and actually one of the infamous communications directors in the Stephen Harper government.
He was the guy who, in the 2015 election, did the expectation game exactly backwards and suggested that if Trudeau just showed up with his pants on, he'd win the debate.
So it's nice to see his name again, I guess. But this whole fiasco, kerfuffle, brouhaha, as it were, it's a really bad news week for the Conservatives. And it has a lot of hints and flavors of the robocall scandal and the Pierre Poutine, some of the questionable things that went on in a couple of the elections and the redirecting people to false polling booths. Basically, the Conservative Party as a whole hasn't had a good number of years on the sort of doing democracy right file, and now having allegations going around of people being signed up without their express consent and a lot of sort of bending the rules doesn't really help any of them. I think some of the leadership contenders want to use it to smear the others and sort of set themselves as the clean white knights. But the only people who can really do that are the people who aren't really positioned to win right now, the people in the sort of second tier. I mean, they can win through the sort of consensus candidate.
And that's why you've seen Lisa Raitt call for the cheaters to be expelled. And you know, if Bernier and O'Leary are suddenly off the ballot. Well, that's just completely changed the whole status of the race in a very interesting way. Now, there's no sign that's actually going to happen, but you can see why the second tier are calling for it.
Well, one thing we are starting to see happen is in the iPolitics weekly polling, there have started to be some shifts. Now, these probably don't reflect this latest news because it all happened, I think, when they were in the field. But O'Leary and Bernier's support are starting to slip a little, down a couple points, which is roughly margin of error. But Leach is actually up to 17%. Kelly Leach is now ahead of Maxime Bernier in terms of first choice voters. She still has a lot of people who would never vote for her. Not as many as the Kevin O'Leary's, perhaps because some people still don't know who Kelly Leach is, I guess. But it's really just the three of them who've made any name for themselves. Everyone else is below the undecided still.
Yeah, it definitely does take a little shine off of Bernier and O'Leary. And both of them have enough in their, I don't know, the you know, liberal war rooms probably already got a couple ads put together, attack ads put together on them. So maybe this is some of the conservatives wondering how much baggage they're potentially bringing into the party in the next election with this. But just have to see if that ends up really dragging any of these guys down.
Well, for a third segment, I want to do a sort of dive briefly into Jason Kenney's Wild Rose Ride over in Alberta. Jason Kenney, the former Harper cabinet member, star of the Conservative Party of Canada, famously stepped down last year. Well, after he announced he was running for the Progressive Conservative Leadership of Alberta, he kept his MP-ship for a while until he finally stepped down and ran the race full tilt. He's now won the leadership this last weekend, which came really as no surprise to anyone. The only question was going to be how big of a margin, and the answer is he got 70% of the delegates.
On first ballot.
The man's a machine at campaigning. He basically proves that after the 2015 election, when the Alberta NDP won their arguable surprise majority, that the Progressive Conservatives had no clue what they were doing. And lo and behold, the sort of moderate progressive candidate of Richard Starkey got about 20% of the delegates, and everything suggests it's Kenny's team. So he came in on this Unite the Right campaign. He really wants to tear up the Progressive Conservatives, tear up the Wild Rose, and build a right-wing party that could take government in Alberta. Unfortunately, the rules as they stand under the Alberta Elections Act don't allow parties to merge their bank accounts. Parties have to essentially shut down and give all the money in their bank to the government, which is just hilarious because the Wild Rose has $1 million in the bank and there's no way Wild Rosers are going to see $1 million go to the government. Meanwhile, the Progressive Conservatives are pretty much broke. So now the PC members have essentially given all the power to Brian Jean, who's the leader of the Wild Rose, which now scares all the sort of moderate, centrist, progressive conservatives. Like, I have family members who voted conservative all their life and are now like, this isn't the party that I know and I've always belonged to. Like, you have to remember, being a member of the Progressive Conservative Party in Alberta is just what you did. You just got a free membership, I think. Not quite, but if you wanted to vote for who would be the premier, you had to join the party and vote for him. But Kenny's takeover has been so complete. Like, one of the rule changes they did last year was to allow you to be a member of more than one party. As soon as that passed, it was pretty much clear that the party was gone. Because one of the core rules of a partisanship party is that you are a member of that party and no other ones. Like, well, you have to tie your ideology, right? You're tying your...
At least the mainstream parties. Yeah. All the little ones, they don't worry about that rule because any member is a good member at that point.
Exactly. And so throughout this race, we saw this sort of shift to the right that Kenny was running as Sandra Jansen dropped out of the race, citing harassment. She eventually joined the NDP. Donna Kennedy-Glanz also dropping out for similar reasons. And Stephen Kahn, one of the other progressive sort of candidates, dropping out earlier in this year. So you only were left with two other candidates, neither of which mounted much of a defense. And Kenny steamrolled through. What's interesting now is seeing where the progressives of the Progressive Conservatives go. Thomas Lukaszczyk, who was a fairly popular cabinet member in the previous Conservative governments, he lost his seat in the last election because he was an Edmonton MLA and the NDP just swept it. He's pretty much torn up his card, it sounds like now. He's sort of a homeless or a political party-less guy just looking for new options. One thing people are looking at is the Alberta Party, which has one seat with the pretty popular Greg Clark, in at least in his riding. And people who listen to him think he's a smart, intelligent guy who presents that sort of centrist vision. He's not making any clear moves yet, but he did say in an article in this last week that he got a phone call from Preston Manning, of all people. And Manning was suggesting that maybe if Clark sets his sights high enough and sort of swoops up all these center-center-right, he could get a cabinet post in some kind of merged future party. Manning, through his institute, said he has no ability to give cabinet posts in non-existent governments, but he's still a pretty influential person in the conservative movements of Canada, and especially Alberta, so stuff is going on behind the scenes. On the other side, Donna Kennedy Glanz, who had dropped out of that leadership race, is still involved in the party, and she actually came out again in this last week and announced she's now part of Jason Kenney's transition team. So she went from quitting the race, being part of the sort of it's too misogynistic or not a place for a progressive vision for the Conservative Party, to trying to maybe pull the brakes on the Kenney run to the right, like trying to make sure there are still some progressives in the Progressive Conservative Party. I think I heard it on the pollcast as saying she's trying to keep one tent pole up far enough apart from the other one that the tent can actually still stand and be useful. I like that analogy. So we have all of this has just happened in Alberta. The Notley government just released a new budget, which, sort of like the federal one, has bigger deficits, more spending. I think the spending there is coming on a bit faster. Right next door in Saskatchewan, they're also running more deficits because they're similarly unable to survive low oil prices. And now Brad Wall has to come out and he's pitching sales tax increases, service cuts, and just fee increases while still trying to criticize Rachel Notley for not even raising taxes. So I don't really have any conclusions of this other than Alberta's always a wild ride, and if only there was a podcast led by some strategists to break this down for us. And if we want to touch back on the previous segment, Kevin O'Leary today called Rachel Notley, for whatever reason, a vicious, poisonous, toxic cocktail of mediocrity and competence put together, and saying she requires an extreme amount of adult supervision.
Which is rather amusing coming from Kevin O'Leary, of all people. If you were just to put that description out there and ask me to pick someone involved in politics who fits that, Kevin O'Leary is much further up that list than Rachel Notley.
And he's been rightly and widely condemned for what are arguably sexist, just patronizing at least, comments that don't really do anything to enhance the debate. Like if you disagree with the Alberta budget, and as Trevor Tombay, the fairly respected economist, points out in McLean's, it's not that bad of a budget. Like, deficits aren't out of control in Alberta. What's actually the problem in Alberta is they're not raising enough revenue. Spending there is pretty low, but their revenue base is just not keeping up because oil prices are low, and that's just what they've artificially relied on. The unsaid implication almost in there is that Alberta needs a sales tax, or it needs something. I'm not saying the Alberta NDP are going to bring in a sales tax. That's politically toxic, or at least has been for a while. But I think as we see this centrist coalition that doesn't have a political home in Alberta, that's the kind of idea I can see them settling on. I think the Alberta Party itself has been interested in a sales tax for a while. Whether it will ever fly, or whether we'll just see more of the progressives go to the NDP to block a Jason Kenney, Brian Jean Hydra from, you know, going down lakes of fire and those kind of comments. Alberta's just a wild ride.
Moving on to our quick takes, our favorite also-ran party in BC, the BC Conservatives, have actually come up with a new policy proposal, which is interesting and a little adorable in how they went about it. Their proposed policy is to provide a new ferry crossing between Vancouver Island and mainland, but this time by bridging to Gabriola Island, putting a ferry terminal there, and sticking another terminal on Sea Island right by the airport, which, you know, in theory, it should extend the ferry ride a bit, but such a whole whack of new infrastructure.
So the adorable part of this is the image they use to demonstrate this proposal is a printed Google Map image that they then drew on in pen or something, the sort of dotted line of
handwritten notations on...
Yeah, approximately 17 km, and, you know, just like circle, like, ferry, go here. And they may as well have just said, this ferry will be really fast, too.
And well, nobody wants fast ferries in BC anymore, but, like, dock drawing, like, 3-4 kilometers offshore from the mainland.
Like, I'll give them credit. They didn't actually draw a ferry on it, because that just would have been perfect. But what's actually weird to me on the policy itself is this is the first policy of the BC Conservatives, and it's a big, expensive infrastructure project, when what I actually expected from them is, like, we'll get rid of income tax or something. That wouldn't surprise me. It would still be kind of ridiculous and not feasible without a whole bunch of other crazy ideas. So I didn't expect them to pitch a $520 million infrastructure project, which is just covers the cost of the bridge. And so if you go through their actual announcement, which, again, their website is just
adorable, I think is the phrase for you. Just settled on for that.
If you go there and manage to dig your way down to this announcement and read the 1/3 of the page that it actually fills, I don't think you actually even see a costing. And the one thing conservatives do a lot is run up price tags.
Well, they do have a cost, but that is only for the request for proposals. So they're expecting it's going to cost several million dollars to evaluate the proposals on this. And while there aren't exactly clear on the procurement model they'd be using for this, it looks like some version of a P3 or design build contract.
It's not an impressive first announcement from them. We're not going to cover every BC Conservative announcement, obviously. We just thought this map
was worth mentioning.
You have to go look at it.
We will link to it in the show notes, and it's definitely worth a gander. But we made fun of them for not having a huge amount of policy on the website, so we're going to have to give them credit for trying to fill out some of those weaker areas on their website.
Well, moving to one of the bigger parties in BC, the BC Liberals, they had kind of a shitty week. First up, the Vancouver Sun led with a big story about the big donors who are doing big business with the BC government. They did a fairly thorough investigation, which we'll just link to in the show notes rather than getting too deeply into, because we've already talked a lot about their sort of shady dealings. But what's interesting here is just the fact that, at least for me, the Post media is going deep into this sort of fundraising issues and really doubling down on all of the different aspects of it. And it looks like this is going to continue to be a narrative that dogs the Liberal parties and Christy Clark right up until Election Day.
Yeah, it's just, you know, yet another straw being added to that camel's back when it comes to the BC Liberals and how they conduct themselves in their fundraising. But what's striking about this is just kind of how shameless and blatant it is. You know, most governments who are taking big donations at least have the common decency to avoid taking them from companies that are actively engaged in, like, a bidding process or doing significant business directly with the government. But speaking of BC Liberals' political fundraising, the political donations bill we talked about last week has met an untimely death as it died on the order paper when the legislative session finished without having the bill passed, and that is the final legislative session before the election. So we're going into the election with no changes to the fundraising in this province.
This is the bill that would have done almost next to nothing. It would have made the other parties do what the BC Liberals are doing and disclose who their donors are almost in real time, and then set up a committee to eventually do something, maybe, but probably not. It's the only bill, actually, that the Liberals weren't able to pass when they started this session. They had a number of other things they put forward and managed to get all those through, but this apparently wasn't a priority for them. And considering how low the bar was for them to just sort of kick it to the side is just kind of embarrassing. Like, they just want to put the file away.
Yeah, they couldn't even be bothered to go through with a token gesture on this. I guess they're just hoping that people will remember the announcement and think that changes have been made where nothing actually happens.
So while that bill died, the government is also facing extra scrutiny, as a few local lawyers have brought forward a class action lawsuit over taxpayer-funded ads by the government. Most governments recently have been doing sort of economic action plan ads and things like that. The BC government right now is running what the budget has in store for you kind of ads, which, given the budget is this close to the election, a largely campaign issue, it's now ads about how the MSP is being cut, and that's good for you, right? You'll want that in a couple years. It's not clear, of course, if this lawsuit will succeed in any way, or if it'll even be able to be heard before the election, even preliminary hearings, but it's still something to sort of dog the government going through the election period.
We won't likely be seeing the resolution of this before the election, but, you know, expect to continue to kind of kick up a little bit of political hay going forward. On the other side of the aisle, the BC NDP have announced they will side with the mayors on the Massey Tunnel Replacement Project. John Horgan, the NDP leader, said he'd be inclined to defer to the mayors and their opposition to the project. Quote, "I won't rule out a bridge, but I don't believe that a bridge is supported by the mayors, and certainly not supported by the people of Richmond."
The 10-lane mega bridge that Christy Clark proposed to replace the Massey Tunnel's not really supported by anyone that I can see. I mean, there's potentially people south of the Fraser who are interested in it, but outside of that, it's largely unpopular, especially here in Metro Van, where there's an infrastructure plan that does not involve more highways. It involves more transit to move people around without cars.
Yeah, we've talked about the problems of induced demand before on the road infrastructure, and this is definitely just going to exacerbate that. Now, a bridge is needed there. The Massey Tunnel is no longer seismically up to code. There's issues with getting deeper draft ships up to the port facilities upriver. So it made sense to put a bridge there, but, you know, 10 lanes is just crazy excessive. And it's unpopular with basically everyone in the region just because it's such an overkill and waste of all that money to get the extra lanes in when there's other high priority transit and transportation infrastructure needs here.
Well, and this is just a smart position for Horgan to take, because he's not saying a personal opinion about the project itself. He's saying, I'm going to listen to the local mayors, and if they change their tune, I will listen to them. And that way, he's not tied to it. So if he wins, becomes premier, and a different proposal comes forward, he doesn't have to be as directly accused of flip-flopping. He still will be, but he's got some defense to say, look, I'm going with where the people want me to be.
Yeah, and this one isn't nearly as divisive as pipelines, which was the big flip-flopping problem with the last election. So, yeah, overall, fairly smart tact on Horgan's part. The housing issues come up many times here, and we've talked a lot about how it is impacting the Vancouver and BC market, but further afield in Ontario, they're also having some issues with it, and the Toronto housing market's being second to Vancouver in terms of being the hottest market in the country, high prices, and the Ontario government's looking at potentially tackling some of the issues around there too. Specifically, there were some announcements regarding their rent control policies. So NDP MPP, Member of Provincial Parliament, put forward a bill to basically implement rent control on basically anything that got exempt from rent control, i.e. everything post-91, and tighten up a few other things. And the Ontario government's basically announced they're going to be looking at doing something similar, and rent control is one of those policies that, you know, initially sounds good, but as soon as you look into it, it tends to be a massive economic disaster because it just causes housing shortages and underinvestment in maintenance of rental properties, just creates a huge problem. And this, what they call the 91 loophole, but really is an explicit part of the thing, was designed to kind of ease off on those negative aspects of it. And it's just frankly a little bizarre that government seems to be wanting to go back to those questionable and failed policies. And it's just kind of a little shocking how everyone throws everything at the housing problem except, you know, land use reform.
I haven't followed much in Ontario politics, and I haven't delved much into this specific story or even spent much time thinking about rent control. I feel like if I lived in New York, I'd spend a lot of time thinking about it. Everywhere else, you're right, it's largely sort of abandoned. So there is a problem, which is in search of solutions. Here's the one that gets thrown up every few years. The Ontario Liberals haven't put forward legislation to say exactly what they're going to do. So it's, I guess, still an open question of if they go down the proven failure routes or if they find a unique way to actually somehow manage to calm the housing market, support renters, and not fuck everything up. But the Ontario Liberals have a poor track record on that front.
Yes, Canada's most unpopular government has basically managed to screw up every major file it's touched. So, yeah, not holding out hope on this one.
Finally, speaking of everything getting screwed up, Andrew Potter was the former editor-in-chief of the Ottawa Citizen. He's been a McGill professor of journalism for a little while now, until I guess this morning. He penned an article for Maclean's magazine looking at Quebec's culture and using some data to talk about social isolation and the sort of breakdown of social cohesion, and a specific snowstorm and a specific incident in that snowstorm where everything went wrong that could go wrong in Quebec. The infrastructure broke. People were grumpy. A truck driver just refused to move his truck, and everything went to shit. Anytime an Anglophone criticizes Quebec, there's going to be some backlash. And it came large and swift, and now he's resigned. The department has disavowed his column. This was talked about on Canada Land Shortcuts today with Jesse Brown and Jen Gerson, and it was supposed to be their shortcuts where they only take little bits of the episode. They spent most of their episode just sort of laughing at this entire story, so I won't really say anything more than just listen to them schadenfreude and talk about how thin-skinned all of Canada actually is. I think the best thing I took away from that episode was just how we need a series where someone goes around and criticizes everywhere in Canada just to promote outrage, because you could do the same thing about Charlottetown. You could do the same thing about Victoria. You could do the same thing about Yellowknife, I'm sure. And if you're an outsider making fun of the place you don't live, people are going to get mad.
Overall, the whole thing just seems to be a massive overreaction. The article was not flattering towards Quebec, to say the least, but it wasn't nearly as outrageous as some people have suggested. And as we mentioned, the points are largely backed up with data in this, citing, you know, surveys on social trust and other metrics that could, you know, at least plausibly be argued to back up Potter's point. So the fact that there was such pressure and he was basically resigned from his position, yeah, just the whole thing is just a huge overreaction. There's been some suggestion that, you know, members of the Quebec government were leaning pretty heavily on McGill on this one, which I think crosses the line into somewhat inappropriate.
Well, this is the same Quebec government that passed, or this is the Quebec government in a previous incarnation, they passed a motion as a National Assembly condemning Maclean's magazine when they had a cover story about whether Quebec was the most corrupt province. Since that cover story and feature, we've seen mayors being arrested in Quebec and a lot of mob ties. There's good evidence that the article was probably true. a lot of that's being cleaned up now, and that's what good journalism can do. And now you could probably do the same article about BC, and we might be getting to that point. I hope the BC government doesn't come back and pass a motion condemning any newspaper that does it. But yeah, you're probably right that there is some animosity in the Quebec legislature for Maclean's magazine in particular.
Yeah, I'll just add this, that they managed to, you know, make a mountain out of a molehill, and I didn't read the article when it came out, but I certainly have now. So I'm not sure how successful they are in kind of dialing back the amount of news and outrage on this story. And just a final note before we close out the show, the Conservative Party leadership race, which we've touched on a bit in this episode and have done the deep dive in the past, the membership deadline to vote in the leadership race that is currently underway and will be concluded in May is March 28th at 5 p.m. Eastern, or for BC listeners, that'll be Tuesday at 2 p.m. So if you're at all thinking about potentially getting a membership on this one, you know, now's the time to do it because it does close very soon.
And one thing I've been meaning to say all of March, as you may have heard if you listen to other podcasts, it's been Tripod Month, which is not in reference to old free web hosting services. And that joke is for like two of you out there. But it's a month dedicated to encouraging your friends, family, and other non-podcast listening colleagues to check podcasts out. So find someone, install a podcast app on their phone when they're not looking, add Politicos to it, and make them listen to this latest episode, or whichever the last good one was. Maybe we've had a couple. And share it and tweet it and use the hashtag Tripod, TRYPOD.
And that's been Politicos. Finally, for the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca, be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticosPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. If you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.